Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
And we're back for 2017. We've survived the snowpocalypse of 2017.
I don't even think you can really call it a snowpocalypse.
Well, everybody panics every time that there is a freaking snowstorm
here.
Well,
I got to say that, you know, I want to actually give most corporations and, you know, anywhere from Atlanta North credit this year, because it seemed like the school systems, county by county, kind of staggered when all the kids were leaving early and everything. And a lot of businesses seemed to, you know, stagger their hours as well. So it wasn't the absolute clusterfuck that it was, you know,
yeah,
a few years ago.
Everyone, like, cut everybody loose way early when it was still dry outside instead of waiting until the roads were iced over to send everybody home.
Yes.
Like they did that last go-round.
I mean, I will say that, you know, I actually left the office for lunch. I don't know. It was probably 1:30, 2 o'clock, and traffic was a nightmare. You know, it probably took me 20, 30 minutes to get somewhere that would typically take me 5. But by the time I left the office at 5 o'clock, all of the major roadways and everything were clear of traffic, so
yeah, I left the office at once. I was one of those assholes causing traffic.
That's okay.
But one thing to get you through if you are snowed in would be some Strike Force energy. StrikeForceEnergy.com, provider of your veteran-owned business, who makes an excellent energy drink that, of course, sponsors this here fine program you're listening to. And also new for 17, I checked on the website. It is available. Now it comes in 3 different flavors, so you can order grape, orange, and lemon if you want to mix up your Strike Force addiction there.
Yeah, I am curious. You know, I've had the lemon, so I definitely want to try the grape and the orange.
Yeah, I'm assuming a lemon is like just the standard flavor because it
yes.
kind of tasted like lemon. But yeah, I kind of want to go.
That's
grape.
Why it went so well in our sweet tea.
Dude, get some of that grape Strike Force, mix it with some grape Kool-Aid. Be all the way up.
Yes.
And of course, when you go to order that Strike Force, use promo code CigarNerds to get 20% off your order.
Or your subscription.
Exactly. So, what are we smoking this week, Brad?
Well, this week we're going to, you know, smoke something that the name is going to sound familiar to folks, but this is a new version. So we are smoking the Toronto Exodus.
Yeah, if anyone's familiar with the Carlos Toraño brand or Toraño in general, used to be a family-owned operation. But it, you know, last year or two, it got bought by General Cigar. So now it's part of the giant General Cigar conglomerate. But you know, Jack Toraño has come back on as kind of a brand ambassador and marketing guy. But they've definitely switched up their kind of image for this new release. Because, like, the old Toraño brand was very, I don't know, kind of classically styled with, you know, and this new one is, they're almost trying to look like a boutique brand. I mean, very flashy marketing and bands and very colorful. It's definitely a departure from that original aesthetic of their cigars.
I mean, I got to say, they're looking at this brand and all of the, you know, different colors and everything that goes into it, like, that is probably the most eye-catching box,
yeah.
You know, just because of all the multicolors. I mean, you got gold, green, purple, you know, some red and some, you know, brown, yeah. And it just
yeah, the box looks like somebody tie-dyed it. but the original Toraño Exodus line, and this one, you know, as well, this is like the Force in the Exodus series, was to commemorate the Exodus of the original Cuban cigar families that left Cuba once, you know, Fidel and all that took over, which the Taranio family was one of those families that, you know, were an original Cuban family that left during that time. And the box, even though it's very colorful and flashy, you know, has some information about that, you know, tries to commemorate that, you know, expansion and how it changed the cigar industry.
There's a lot of history there. And, you know, that's the thing I love about, you know, just kind of cigar culture and everything else is it's so rich and diverse in history. So, you know, it's the stories behind the cigars oftentimes that I find myself really enjoying, you know, just as much as the cigar themselves. So,
yeah, and this particular version of the Extus has a Honduran San Agustin wrapper with a Connecticut broadleaf binder and fillers from Dominican, Honduran, and Mexican tobaccos.
Yeah, and you know, so I'm finding, you know, that I'm really starting to prefer more of the Nicaraguan grown you know, tobaccos and stuff like that. But you know, for a Honduran, you know, first lighting this up, you know, it was just, all right, it is what it is. A little bit mild to my palate. But, you know, as I'm starting to, you know, get into the first third or so, I'm starting to, you know, get a little bit of a transition into some leathers and a little bit of spice. And, you know, it's starting to, you know, add in complexity and, you know, also, too, a little bit in strength. I still would not say that this is a full cigar. I would say, you know, at best, maybe a medium full based on what I'm getting out of it right now. As we get into the main segment and further along into the cigar, that may or may not change. That's TBD.
Yeah, this, like the original Extus 59 was probably one of my favorite cigars. And this one, and it was definitely a medium plus bordering on a full flavored, of our full strength, full flavored cigar. But this one's, like I said, is, like you said, a little bit milder in that, but it's got a lot of good flavors, so we'll see how it progresses.
Absolutely. So do you want to tell the fine folks what we're going to be talking about for this episode?
Know what I mean?
I know what you mean, Vern.
Yes, 2017 marks the 30th anniversary of Ernest Goes to Camp. So we're going to talk about Jim Varney and his great American character of Ernest P. Worrell.
And after all the sad news of 2016, like, I felt like we should start 2017, you know, with some humorous, some light topic, and fuck 2016, glad it's over.
And with that, we'll be right back. To the podcast. It's time to talking about an American legend.
Yeah, probably one of the most iconic redneck figures that I can think of from my childhood anyway.
Yeah, I mean, as a Southern American.
You mean just all around good patriot American?
Yeah, yeah. You grew up knowing who Ernest P. Even if you didn't know who Jim Varney was, you knew who Ernest P. Worrell was.
In fact, you probably just knew Ernest and had no clue that it was actually Jim Varney.
Yeah.
Like, his character is more iconic than, you know, his actual, you know, legal name.
Yeah, and it's kind of amusing how it all got started because, you know, Ernest P. Worrell, played by Jim Varney. It started off as one of those, I mean, now with the rise of YouTube, the weird, you know, local commercial characters have kind of become legend, because you can always look up weird, just screwed up freaking local commercials on YouTube or whatever. And that's pretty much where you know, the character of Ernest got started, was like these, I think like his, the first one was for some amusement park. And then he got, like I said, it, the popularity of kind of grew where he was like doing this character for car lots and, you know, different businesses, where it was getting franchised out like across the nation. So that's pretty much where, you know, before he became like a television and movie star, you know, the character of Ernest P. Worrell was something that would pop up on your freaking TV during the middle of your, you know, back when you had to watch commercials back in the day.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can remember, you know, still a number of commercials that featured, you know, iconic, you know, characters that were specifically used in advertising campaigns. And, you know, sitting around talking to, you know, my grandma and stuff like that, I mean, we still reminisce about, you know, that or particular taglines that, you know, have just carried on for, you know, 20, 30 years now.
Yeah, because that whole, like, you know what I mean, Vern? I mean, that all came from some of those early ads. And I mean, I remember seeing one where it was, it might have been for natural gas or something, where he was always popping up, you know, giving his buddy Vern, that you never see, who was always the perspective of the audience, advice on how to fix things. You know, hey, Vern, you should be using natural gas. It's, you know, it's like, you know, quick, hot, and fast, kind of like your first wife. Yeah, and like, and then, you know, he'd always end up slamming a door in his face or dropping something on him to get him the hell out of his house.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, just so many of those running gags, and just, I don't know. I mean, that's, it's so iconic. I mean, hell, there's, you know, an entire YouTube series like dedicated of Ernest how-to videos, and of course, like, it's the shenanigans and stuff like that that have taken place, you know, little snippets from the film, like, you know, and Ernest goes to school and there's the whole plumbing incident. It's like, Ernest teaches you how to do household plumbing.
Yeah, these stupid ads were so popular, they even released a, you know, movie pretty much that was just a collection of all his old bits and commercials. So, I mean, it was popular enough that these stupid commercials got their own, like, you know, at least a VHS direct-to-video release. But kind of, it's kind of, you know, says something about the character that, you know,
yeah,
you
well,
wouldn't
I mean,
even watch
I think,
him on.
You know, the early Ernest films, you know, I think there were a couple of theatrical releases. But, you know, then after that, it was pretty much straight to VHS at the time. And
yeah, it's Ernest, the Ernest Film Festival is the collection of all his old, like, TV commercials released as a movie.
Yeah, you know, which it's kind of cool, you know. I mean, Jim Varney went on to, you know, actually in the movie version of the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, ended up playing Jed Clampett, and then, you know, then also, too, did, like, some of the voice acting and stuff in Toy Story and Toy Story 2 with Slinky the Dog.
Yeah, Slinky Dog.
Yeah, or Slinky Dog, not Slinky the Dog.
Yeah, so he had a legitimate acting career outside of this hillbilly character that he made popular. But, you know, it's kind of like will be forever known as Ernest.
Yes. So, you know, we're here today to basically, you know, carry on the legacy of Ernest and talk about, you know, some of his highlights, his demises, and I don't know, you know, I mean, in a way, I've always had respect for this character because, you know, through all of the random crap that he gets himself into, or he always does it, you know, out of the best of intentions. Like, he is probably one of the most pure-hearted, you know, characters portrayed.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the reason why everyone, you know, loves that character is because of all the shenanigans and bad stuff that he causes or happens to him, it's never out of malice. He is, like I said, he is the most pure-hearted person. That, like, no, I'm just stupid. I'm not doing any of this stuff to intentionally fuck people up. It's just, I'm stupid. And
maybe,
I mean well.
Maybe with the, you know, the Krieger, you know, mining folks, you know, toward the end of Ernest Goes to Camp. I mean, you know, he's flat out launching some explosives at folks. I mean.
Yeah. Well, let's get in that, because, and I also remember before we even get into the movie, and I think it either came out right after the movie or right before, was he even had his own, like, sketch comedy show for a little while called Hey Vern, It's Ernest, which got him a, you know, a Daytime Emmy Award for Best Children's Programming. You know, like I said, I was probably in 87, I was like maybe 8 years old, so that was one of those, like, things that, like I said, you know, would watch all the time. And I can't remember what I saw first, Ernest Goes to Camp or his TV show, but...
Yeah, I remember, you know, I can remember discussions about the TV show, but unfortunately, I never got to, you know, being at the age of two. If I'm sure my parents and my, you know, grandparents were watching this stuff, but, you know, I was still sucking on, you know, my mom's tits, so I don't remember.
But it was one of those things that it was like, what should we call it? The, like I said, early, I don't know, that, and then that could also be because, like I said, I was a huge sketch comedy fan. You know, I liked Saturday Night Live and all that stuff. But that stuff at 8 years old was a little bit too adult for me. But I'm sure my love of comedy started from watching Ernest do dumb shit. Because, you know, most during that time, if you're watching comedy, it's cartoons. I mean, this was like, you know, one of the few live action comedies for children, or at least, you know, younger people at
the
time.
I mean, and you know, I'm kind of wondering, like, you know, was this comedy? Because, I mean, by and large, the Ernest films were, you know, pretty clean, you know, outside of a couple of, you know, dams here or there. Yeah. Like, there was nothing that, you know, would deem, you know, a PG-13 or anything rating.
And some of the stuff that came out of that show, too, because I remember the... have you ever
it's
heard
not
of
like a Bob Saget.
Yeah.
Like, Bob Saget, you attribute to America's Funniest Home Videos and actually watch his stand-up comedy and like, huh, that is not the same person.
Well, it's like, I don't know if anyone's even, you know, old enough to remember this, but the Mr. Bill, the little Play-Doh guy that would always have bad stuff happening to him, that came out of, you know, the Ernest TV show. It was like one of the you know, few animated type things that they they did. And also, like, with this and the later the movies, you know, slapstick comedy has kind of died off. We don't really have any that I can think of the top of my head to point to of slapstick comedy
anymore. No, I mean, most of it just tries to focus on, like, a crude or gross-out factor, or, you know, poking fun at, you know, whether it be religion or whatever the case is. Like, there's a... social comedy, I guess, is how I would, you know, classify
it. Yeah, people just
it.
Being stupid and falling down or getting hit with and hurt and stuff doesn't really, you know, happen that much in our modern comedy era. But, you know, this right here was probably
which is an error.
Yeah. It was probably, like I said, you know.
Kind of waiting on a Three Stooges reboot or something now.
I don't know. They made that Three Stooges movie, but I heard it was horrendous. I never saw it. That had that guy from Mad TV is in it. Yeah, I did not hear good things, so I did not waste my time. But what good is that documentary they did about they did a movie about the Three Stooges, like the actors, not like
the characters.
That was pretty good, but the new version of the Three Stooges, no, do not do not bother. But anyway, like I said, this, you know, back in 1987, we got the first big screen appearance of Ernest, or at least the one everyone remembers, Ernest Goes to Camp.
Yeah, and I mean, I grew up watching this movie. I mean, I don't really know. I can recall Land Before Time being very young and seeing that, but I this was one of the ones, you know, that I recall, you know, I watch this movie every couple of years, it seems, that, you know, whether it be on TBS or, you know, one of the other, you know, cable movie stations or whatever, it just seems to emerge. Like, you know, Moose's character is always the one that kind of stands out.
Yeah, directed by John Cherry III. starring Jim Varney and, I mean... I think there might have been a movie prior to this that had the character of Ernest, but he wasn't, like, the star in it. You know, he was, like, you know, part of a skit. This is, like, the first one where it's, like, all Ernest all the time.
Yeah, and I think this is the first one that, you know, also, you know, has Ernest in the title of the movie, too.
Yeah, because this started like a whole series. Pretty much everything that came after was Ernest Goes Insert Adventure Here.
I mean, for him to be a small town redneck, I mean, Ernest is going places.
Boy, that dude's been all over. He even went to Africa once. Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
We'll talk about that in the later.
Yeah, Ernest Goes to Camp. And this one really kind of, yeah, as I've watched a few of these this week, kind of set the formula for an Ernest movie where Ernest does something, then he ultimately fails and makes the situation way worse, and then you have the moment of
epiphany,
or the sad moment, and then him like, oh no, I can fix this, and more shenanigans ensues, but usually ultimately has a successful outcome.
Yeah, I mean, for Ernest to be, such, the main focus and iconic, like, I think the thing that makes his character so dynamic is the supporting, actors and actresses and everything else that always gives him that motivation boost, or, that pep talk or whatever, hey, you can do it. It's that sense of camaraderie. I don't know, for it to be, so focused on him, like, it's all the other people, too, that really, I guess just bring everything full circle.
Because he really is, like, a man-child in these movies, too, where he's like, that's why these are always such great, I mean, you can enjoy them as adults, but ultimately they were great kids' movies. There's always some kind of, like, kid sidekick in the movies, but Ernest himself was, like, the biggest kid. That's why it kind of translated
That's the whole thing,
To everything.
I think that's the reason, and we'll talk about it later, that Ernest Scared Stupid, that whole formula really worked, with, he needs to have the heart of a child and, pure at mind and blah, 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 because, I mean, that's him. He's a big kid. He likes to, I mean, look at the inside of his house. All the contraptions and everything else, like, I could see, like, Ernest, like, patenting, like, sending, like, so many fly-by-night patent companies ideas and stuff, like.
Yeah, because that's, they touch on it a little, he has, like, that's the other aspect of the character that, that he's kind of like not only is he, whatever he's doing in that particular movie, but he's kind of a amateur scientist, engineer, freaking inventor. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, and this one he has his homemade barbecue rotisserie machine that eventually like sucks him into the machine and tries to roast his feet.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that, but then, too, like, the whole contraptions that they end up building and everything else to take on the mining corporation when they start moving in the heavy equipment. So they, freaking chop off the top of the bus, and they got all kinds of freaking catapults and, everything else on it. And, then the, like, two of the most common recurring characters, out of the Ernest franchise.
Yeah, there's always like the one fat guy and the old man. What were their names?
So it was
it was Bobby
Gillard,
and
Sartan, and Bill Barge, but and Ernest Goes to Jail, they play the security guards as Chuck and Bobby.
Yeah. And there was also, because it's funny, like, Bobby's not in Ernest Goes to Camp, but the other guy is, and he plays the camp chef, who's a kind of a weird inventor of himself, who has, he's trying to come up with some of the eggs erroneous, which sounds really, but that's actually mistake eggs. It's like some weird, Tibetan thing.
Modeling clay.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny, he's trying to convince Ernest to try it. He's like, a hungry lion hunts best, which that line comes up in a couple other other movies. But yeah, they eventually invent this machine that it's like the, which kind of remind me a lot of like old,
it's the very first food processor, literally.
You just throw stuff in it and it like shoots out the finished product. But I remember like in the 80s, there was this whole like people selling weird inventions, like the pocket fisherman or Or I remember from Gremlins, the dad was selling all these weird like gadgets and stuff. Yeah, and that's what it kind of reminded them.
It cooks, it cleans, it vacuums, it's your all-in-one.
That they later use in the final battle as a some kind of disgusting food launcher.
I mean, which was the only practical purpose anyway, because in the kitchen, that shit did not launch. Like, it's so funny. It'd be like all over the walls and everything. There's nothing in the actual pan or pot.
Well, it's funny if you notice the stuff that was launching out was a completed dish. He's like, hey, lobster bisque. We put this thing in it. And it looked like lobster bisque when it exploded against the wall. So it at least partially works. They just got to dial in the launching mechanism.
But I don't know, man. It kind of lost me when they started throwing rubber chickens and everything else in there. Like, that's not going to be good.
Or was it the Alfredo sauce? Yes. They throw the fettuccine in there, and then they throw like a little doll of some Italian guy, and it's like, it's me, Alfredo.
That, or, you know, going back to the lobster bisque, where it's like, please don't throw me in the food processor 2000. I don't want to go. Well, you're going. So in goes the lobster. Like, you do that nowadays, and PETA would have a riot.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, back to this movie, Ernest plays a camp handyman who's like, his one dream is to finally be a camp counselor, you know, in a non-Jason movie. And this camp gets elected to be part of some government outreach program where they send troubled kids, you know, that otherwise would be in some kind of like either, criminal institute
like
or a
detention center or like a...
Or a whatever, orphan's home thing, to send them to the camp for the summer. And none of the counselors want to deal with these kids. And eventually, and to keep them from having to get sent back, they're like, we'll make this idiot take care of these kids. And Ernest gets the promotion he's been after all his time.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's just an all-around feel-good movie, too. I mean, you know, because the whole, you know, progression of the kids and everything else. But
yeah, because they start off, you know, pretty much little thugs that don't want to participate, and then eventually they kind of, you know, basically we're going to join in the camp life just to show these other assholes that have been picking on us that we can do it. And then eventually learn that, oh yeah, we actually enjoy this stuff and we want to save the camp when it comes.
I mean, there's the whole epiphany, you know, where the nurse has, you know, all of the kids and they're packing up, you know, because the government, you know, or the mining corporation is set to demolish the town. And,
yeah,
because
the evil mining corporation tricks. This whole camp is owned by an Indian chief. He's like the last of his tribe. And nobody can communicate him with him except for his daughter, the nurse, or
Ernest,
who knows like the...
And I think the head camp,
yeah,
person,
like the sound, the, some kind of Indian sign language stuff. Yeah, they... lie to Ernest, oh yeah, this is, you want to sign this petition to help stop the mining company and protect the river.
Well,
so the chief,
like, hey,
okay,
we work for a water conservation, yeah, thing, and you know, we want to protect the water. So, you know, basically, you know, Ernest with his third grade IQ doesn't read any of the paperwork, has the chief sign, and seals the camp's fate.
Yeah.
So we think.
So yeah, he, you know, eventually steps, like, I caused this problem, I'm gonna stop this mining company, and gets his ass ultimately kicked.
Yes, I want to know the punk that's in charge of this mining corporation.
And I can't, whoever the big guy who plays the head foreman,
yeah, I
of
know
the mining
the,
company.
I know
I've seen him in like a bunch of like old 80s action movies. He must have been like a stuntman or something, because that dude is basically played an enforcer in I don't know how many different like 80s action movies.
Let's see. Was it... Oh, I'm trying to remember the guy... the dude's name now, because it's just a mountain of a man. And yeah, it's Lyle Alzado, who is the the freaking construction foreman.
Yeah, him, like I said, yeah, he ultimately beats Ernest's ass. And then there's the whole like, oh, it's raining, this is super sad, which I know some people, anytime they watch this movie, they cry at that part. It's not me, but a listener. Because he sings to his turtle, and it's supposed to be really, really sad.
Dude, that turtle is a straight-up asshole.
Yeah, fucking bites his nose. He's like, the only way we can get it off is to sing it to sleep. So he starts singing that, it's you and me. That whole, like, friendship song to get the turtle let go of his nose. And that's kind of Ernest's thing too, because like literally before the kids kind of join him, the turtle's his only friend, and even his only friend like fucks him over. It's
like, but it's funny how they use a tortoise to portray a snapping turtle, though. I was like.
Yeah, I'm like, that's not a thing.
Yeah, the likelihood of that tortoise actually biting. But then it is funny, you know, once they actually, like, set up, like, the army of tortoises. So they got these, you know, freaking parachuting turtles, like, attacking everybody. Yeah,
and as they're about to launch him, it's like, he's like, I'm scared, Sarge. We're all scared. It's like, freaking, you know, all of a sudden the turtles have monologues. It's kind of... But yeah, then that leads into another great staple of the 80s when Ernest decides, like... Or the kids, like, you convince them, like, we have to save the camp and use their delinquent skills to weaponize. And it was, like, such a A-team sequence. I mean, because that was one of the things I loved about this movie when I was a kid.
Oh, dude, that was a straight-up 80s gear montage.
Yes. Like. The freaking... Which, one thing I noticed when I rewatched it, when they break into the explosives bunker at the construction site, they steal smoke bombs. Hey, what does a construction company need with smoke bombs? If you're going to steal explosives, steal explosives. What are the freaking smoke bombs going to do for you?
Well, I guess it's, you know, when I was a kid, smoke bombs were more of just a nuisance and a mischievous thing. They weren't something that would put you on an FBI watch list.
True.
So, you know, I guess, like, portraying kids actually stealing explosives would be a bad idea.
But later on, they, in their you know, repertoire of their freaking A-team-esque battle wagon they build with a catapult made with a boat and whatnot. They're launching flaming arrows out of this, like, you know, thing that would, like, had, like, 10 bows hooked up together. So they're already shooting flaming arrows into a crowd of people. And the overpressurized kerosene lantern missiles that they launch, blowing up cars and stuff. So, I mean, is it a step too far to throw some dynamite? I mean...
I don't know.
I mean, even that toilet, like, blew up some stuff.
Well, then the whole toilet thing, like, made no sense to me. Like, you know, do they plug up the bottom of the toilet? Because otherwise there would just be a bunch of nothing because the bottom of the toilet is hollow. Like, so that never quite made sense to me how they made the flaming poo toilet, like, actually function.
And speaking of his weird facial tics... That's one of the things that always hit me. When he first goes to unclog the toilet, when he just looks at the camera, and is like, eww. Like, I think I've used that in, like, daily life anytime I come across something disgusting. It's one of those, like, you know, as much of, know what I mean, Vern, is a catchphrase, the ooh face yes. is, like, one of his other, like, you know, greatest catchphrases.
I mean, that's the one expression that, you know, if anybody hears the name Ernest, that automatically kind of gets attributed to his character. Although he had quite a few other great expressions, they just didn't catch on.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's this whole backstory in the movie of, you know, before the camp was a kid's camp, it was a, like basically like a ceremonial ground for this Indian tribe, which they had the, what do they call it, the ceremony of the
brave
of yeah, but it was they call it the blade, the rock, and the arrow. Yes. Where you know to young braves to show that they were destined to be warriors, they basically tie him to a target and throw a knife at him, throw a hatchet at him, and then try to shoot him with an arrow. And if they all missed, they were you know deemed worthy of the Great Spirit to become warriors. Is that or the head like ceremony guy was just a really shitty aim?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I'm like. Man, I hope they only had one guy dedicated to that ceremony. Get somebody up there that's an actual marksman, you're toast. We need a new tribe. Nobody's got bravery here.
Yeah. But then, you know, once the head mining guy who's shows up and is enough tired of their shenanigans of stopping his... He actually shows up with a gun and tries to shoot Ernest and misses like three times in a row. But earlier they had to show like a sequence of him shooting bottles to show... Oh no, he's not just a really bad aim. He could actually shoot stuff to, you know, put this you know, other thing in perspective.
I mean, but he didn't have a case or anything else. He just throws the rifle in the front seat. I'm saying that scope is probably knocked off zero. Like, I mean, yeah. If we want to talk, you know, real physics and reality, like
But yeah, you know, trying to shoot Ernest and missing every time, you know, kind of, you know, Ernest has gone through the path of the brave and is now a true Indian warrior. And still gets zero respect after he saves the camp. Because, like, he's like, yeah, I'm a permanent camp counselor. And he's, you know, hanging up the sign to reopen the camp. And, you know, again, because at first in the movie, he falls off the ladder because he forgot to hook his safety rope. This time he falls off the ladder again. And he's like, oh, I made the safety rope too long. And pulls on it, and the whole sign falls on him.
And then you see the chief over there, and it's like, what happened? And the chief in plain English, Ernest broke the sign.
And then the head camp counselor guy's like, well, at least no one was hurt. It's like through the whole movie. So like, Ernest gets like fucked up. He's like, what's happening here? Ernest was showing us first aid. Well, no one was hurt. Yeah, and it's like, nobody cares. And the whole running gag of the golf cart that's just driving by itself through the whole movie, just like through the background, it finally shows up and like they turn it into like a bomb and blow up this bulldozer that's destroying the... And Ernest finally gets to punch the... not just punch him. He like straight bitch slap, like a nice pimp slap to the guy who had kicked his ass earlier and redeems himself.
Yes. No, the whole golf cart thing, though. I mean, I had a golf cart like that, exactly like that model growing up as a kid. And I just got to say that there is no way that golf cart drove by itself, because you're talking about a device that was just made to flip over on its side. Like, three wheels, and you've got one bar that stretches, you know, evenly from the passenger and the driver's seat. Like, I can't tell you how many times I'd have friends on it and just intentionally will fuck you up and grab the handle, and next thing you know, you're on your side.
I'm going to say, how many times did you break some? Yeah, there's no way that thing kept going straight when Ernest, like, you know, jumped off of it.
No.
And then at the end, you see it drive by all burnt up from exploding, but it's still, you know, running on its own. Some damn good craftsmanship there.
I mean, dude, this is, you know, that thing was probably made in America back then.
True.
We didn't have mass production, so.
This was the 80s. Oh. But yeah, that kind of, and it made a lot of, I mean, made for $3 million, made $23.5 million. I mean, that was a huge, you know, success back then for something that started from an idiot doing, you know, car commercials.
I mean, dude, if I could give somebody, you know, a buck and get almost 10 times my return on that investment, shit, that's good even in today's terms.
Yeah. Like, and like I said, you know, we already talked about this movie when we did one of our Christmas episodes, but you know, the follow-up movie to this was Ernest Saves Christmas, which in itself was like, I mean, that's still... Yeah, you know, I watch that around Christmas time, you know, off and on. You know, that's was like another one of like a great movie. So I don't want to spend too much time on it. But like I said, he had a series of great follow ups, and then you know, Ernest Rides Again kind of bombed. But then that didn't stop him. He kept, you know, releasing these straight to video, low budget Ernest movies all the way up until, you know, 98.
Yeah, man. I mean, I used to rent the shit out of these movies, like back when there were actually places you could go and rent VHS tapes. Like, most people's not going to understand what that even is anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, I keep seeing like these memes. It's like, I was hiking through the woods and came to this abandoned shopping center, and I see this big yellow sign that says Blockbuster. What the hell is this?
When we went to Ohio for that steampunk mention, there was a Blockbuster sign. And I was like, did we go through a time warp? Because like, the building wasn't there anymore, but there's still like a sign on the shopping center that said Blockbuster.
Yes.
It was right next to the White Castle.
Which was still in business.
Yep. But another one of probably my favorite Ernest movies has got to be Ernest Scared Stupid. His like attempt at a, you know, Halloween horror comedy.
Yeah, and you know, I actually really enjoy this film. I mean, once Halloween time rolls around, this is kind of one of those films I watch, much like Ernest Saves Christmas. Like, I mean, it's almost a tradition. Something feels, you know, not right if I don't, you know, happen to see one of these films around that time. So
yeah, this one, too, was directed by,
John Archery,
who directed Ernest Goes to Camp. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, this one was probably, you know, where the Ernest Goes to Camp was, you know, kid-friendly. This one was even more so. I mean, it, like I said, it really focused on the kids, but, and this weird troll. The whole thing is this.
I think I've seen that used in several other bad B horror movies too.
Where, like, you know, Ernest is the garbage man of this small town, where there's a legend that one of his ancestors had stopped a troll that was taking kids and doing some, turning them into, like,
wooden dolls, and that's
basically
how
he needed
powers.
To kill five kids or entrap five kids to raise a troll army. And, you know, they buried him alive because they couldn't kill him, and planted a tree on top of him, and was like, but he, before he was buried, he's like, I curse you, and one day a member of your family will free me, and I will again walk the earth. And apparently part of the curse was anyone in his family would progressively get dumber and dumber until we finally get to Ernest. But he, again, he's, you know, the town garbage man and an amateur inventor where, you know, remote control garbage truck cleaning devices goes horrible. I gotta say, and in this one, they give him a sidekick of a dog who is a complete asshole. That dog is like when he gets like,
dude, Rimshot is not an asshole. He just can't read.
Yeah, that's true. Because like, yeah, when he falls into the garbage truck, you know, the dog does hit the crush lever, and I mean, he eventually honks the horn until somebody comes and helps. But
I mean, Ernest the whole time is like, hey, hit these levers. Like, the dog's just doing what it was told, hitting levers. Like.
But later on, there's a fight scene between Ernest and the troll, and the dog is driving the car. So I got to give him props. He the dog has.
And I mean,
some
the
skill.
Dog does try to. Well, I don't know about this film, but I know when Ernest goes to jail, like the dog, you know, is trying to take down fake Ernest all throughout the film. You know, I mean, little dog can't expect much, but at least little guy's trying.
Well, there's the part where Ernest is trying to set a trap for the troll and has this giant, basically giant bear trap. And he's like, hey, give me that stick to, like, hold this thing shut. And the dog won't bring him the stick. So.
But, dude, when you've got a bear trap that opens to a 6-foot diameter and you're outstretched, like, I guarantee you, had he removed one of his arms to grab the stick, like, he would have been snapped anyway. Like, that was inevitable. that's like a, you know, you would need like a 6-person like team to like set that trap properly.
Yeah, so the whole thing is like these neighborhood kids that are Ernest's friends, they get picked on by these bullies, and he's like gives them this whole speech about, you know, military tactics, that you must find the high ground. And he goes off in this whole like freaking tangent where he's basically they brought in all the characters from his like TV show and these like weird, like, you know, characters he did in some of his skits, you know, explaining all these things. And, you know, the tree he picks out to build the kids'
of course
treehouse,
they gotta go through like the freaking dark woods that's filled with fog and everything else, and come to like the most obvious tree that's like, dude, I mean, that might as well be the fucking tree from The Evil Dead.
Yeah. I think that might have been the tree they buried Pumpkinhead under in the
quite possibly.
Movies. I mean, and of course, you know, if anyone who's fans of like the original Batman TV series, Eartha Kitt, the season 3 Catwoman, plays like the local crazy witch lady who is the only one that knows about this, you know, weird troll, and she does crazy very well. Yes. I mean, she was, you know, an exceptional actress in this, you know. So Ernest goes she's like, what are you doing with this tree? And he's like, building a tree house, and like freaks out. So he goes talk to her, and comes back, and he's like, yeah, she told me supposedly there's a troll buried on this tree, and if some of the, you know, my descendants were ever to put their hand on the tree and say awaken, yada yada yada, he's like, you know, but what's the odds of that happening? And just like his dumbassness like unleashes the two-nosed.
I mean, it's about like
troll.
Giving him, you know, the knowledge of the Necronomicon. Like, just don't do it.
Yeah, that, now there's a movie I want to see. Ernest versus the Evil Dead.
I think the Deadites would give up and just be like, we can't match the level of stupidity.
I do like the one scene where the troll is kind of following Ernest as he's like, you know, trying to set up his troll warrior stuff and goes into this convenience store. And the clerk sees the troll behind Ernest and is like freaking out. And he can't speak. And he's like, what? You playing charades? I'm going to trick you. He's like, two what? And the guy finally pulls out a double barrel. He's like, two barrels. Oh, I get it. And the guy like faints. He's like, man, you take charades seriously. Pulls a shot. Oh. But I guess it, also in this, the, you know, as kind of a fan of horror and makeup effects, the trolls in this movie were, you know, when the, you know, spoiler alert, the trolls are ultimately unleashed and Ernest and the town folk have to fight them off. Like each troll, it wasn't like a cookie cutter design. Each troll had its own look and personality nearly. And the main troll, like I said, they were very disgustingly done.
Yes.
Like you would not want to touch these things. They, I mean, they were, you know, like props to whoever did these special effects on this movie.
I'll give you a dollar if you touch it.
Nope. That does not work. Maybe for a taco. And then ultimately, like we said before, you know, the legend of how to fight the troll is someone must be have the heart of a child and, you know, a mother's, what was it, like a mother's...
like kindness or something.
Yeah, something like that. And you know, eventually figure out that milk kills the trolls. So the, you know, the kids like, you know, get a whole bunch of water guns and Ernest even like they made like a some kind of like basically a potato gun on the tower. So he's like launching like yogurt bombs out of this thing, like killing trolls.
That's almost as bad as like aliens. Like why would, like milk is in vast quantity on this planet. Like why, like in aliens it's like, oh, their weakness is water. Like came to a place that's 80% water.
No, you're thinking of Signs.
Maybe. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's it. Signs. Yeah, yeah, but why and you... baseball bats. It's like, come on, trolls. Do yeah. better.
Yeah, I can understand like when the old-timey people had trouble, you know, taking out the trolls because might not have been a lot of milk back then. But
I mean,
today's...
you'd have to like freaking go out there and milk the cow. There's
I mean,
no,
let's go hang
like...
out at Dairy Queen. You're going to be safe. Like. Oh, yeah, but the, you know, and he eventually, it's the weirdest thing is like, that whole thing about, you know, a mother's, we finally realize that, oh, it's because the main troll, like, you know, basically, almost like, you know, some Power Ranger stuff, you know, once he gets his ass kicked, has to, like, level up to, like, the next level, and at that point, he's immune to milk because he's so overpowered that unconditional love is the only thing that will destroy him, you know, because, of course, kids' movie, gotta have a message. So Ernest has to, like, go hug him to ultimately kill him. He hugs him and kisses him on his nose, and he explodes.
I was not prepared for love.
It's like the Beatles say, man, all you need is love.
Just let it go.
Oh, God. I wonder how many people had to suffer through that freaking Frozen song during the snowpocalypse this weekend.
I bet a lot of parents did that willingly.
Yeah. Because I know I made freaking Let It Snow jokes this weekend just because of that shit. And also may have made a snow penis. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah. That story doesn't work without a visual.
Hey, there wasn't enough snow to make a snowman. So I did the next best thing.
Made a snow woman?
Oh, no, because yeah, like, you know, that actually requires more snow, because, you know.
All right, we're going to leave it alone.
Anyway.
We're probably the only one that can take a friend to the episode and, you know, completely, like, make it inappropriate for children to ever listen to.
Hey, it's 2017, man. New year, same bad jokes.
Sounds about right. I've been listening to them for about the last decade, so it only seems fitting.
Yeah, true.
At some point, you're going to come up with some new material.
Oh, but a... So what's some other great Ernest movies? Because you were able to review a couple more than I had.
Well, I think we need to talk about Ernest Goes to Jail. I mean, you know, this... It's just all around... You know, one of the you know, other formulas for a good Ernest film is, you know, Jim Varney has to play multiple characters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that's just kind of the given. And at some point, there has to be an electrocution of some sort that magnetizes Ernest. And, you know, so this film kind of had all of those, but, you know, we do see, you know, the shenanigans happen in other films as well.
And this is probably the last one I remember seeing, like, as a theatrical release. And it's, like, the second most successful of the Ernest films. And again, directed by John Cherry, came out in 1990. But, yeah, in this one, Ernest gets selected for jury duty. And the person whose trial it is, this gangster killer guy, happens to look exactly like Ernest.
Yes.
So, you know, they somehow trick the judge and be like, hey, you know, if y'all going to prosecute me, y'all have to come and see the defense attorney is like, y'all have to come see the scene of the crime, which happened, apparently he killed somebody inside a prison, which this thing was actually filmed at Nashville State Penitentiary. Nashville and Tennessee State Penitentiary. So once they get him in the prison, they switch him out so he can escape, and Ernest is forced to, you know, be punished for evil Ernest's crimes.
Yeah, and it is so funny, you know. I mean, even up until the thing. So, you know, the backstory here is, you know, Ernest has to have some kind of handyman job. So in this film, he is, you know, the bank janitor. And, you know, his end goal is to become a bank clerk. Well, Ernest is not very educated nor people-oriented, good at communicating. So probably not a person you want handling your day-to-day financial transactions.
Math is a bitch.
But anyway, like the two security guards that we talked about, Chuck and Bobby, that were in some of the other films. Anyway, like they're playing red light, green light, and Ernest is, you know, once again, he's taking a floor cleaner and tried to, you know, slightly modify it a bit. Anyway, shit gets out of control, so he's up on the ceiling and the walls and everything else with this freaking floor machine and basically trashes the bank, and the head, you know, bank owner, I can't remember the guy's name, something starts with a P, I think. Anyway, whatever, you know. It's basically like, Ernest, you're a screw-up. You know, if you don't figure out how to improve, you can forget about ever becoming a clerk, but then again, you're fired. So, you know, the whole, that's a little bit of the premise. So, you know, the thing is, with the jury duty, like, they're all the jurors are standing around, and, like, the inmates are roaming free, which is kind of weird. So, I mean, yeah, they're still in the facility, but, you know,
Felix Nash was the evil Ernest.
So, you know, it was just rather interesting. Like, you know, and the freaking cellmates, you know, of Nash, like, basically, you know, Nash is probably a little bit of a hard ass, but he's got his henchmen that do, you know, most of the, you know, intimidating and dirty work and stuff like that. So, you know, they're basically trying to teach Ernest how to be Nash, you know, so the, you know, freaking warden and everybody else is not like, dude, you're not yourself. What the fuck is this? But one of the most iconic scenes, I think, is, you know, Ernest is sitting there in the cell with blocks of soap and everything else and freaking makes an assault rifle. And, you know, the you know, and he's like, warden, open up and let me out or blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the freaking wax just starts melting. Like, I was just like, damn it. Talk about shitty luck.
Which is funny because that, like, I can't remember what actual gangster did that, but a guy carved a gun out of, like, it was either, like, wood or soap or something and, you know, dyed it black with iodine and used it to escape a prison. So, I mean, a plan could have worked. if he had not you know, heard him on that one.
I mean, could have, but, you know, so
I think it might have been Dillinger did that.
But it was, you know, crazy because, you know, Nash is set to, you know, be executed by electric chair. So, you know, of course, what happens? They put Ernest in the chair, but it's weird because they don't freaking put the cap on him or anything else. So, anyway, they just flip the switch. Electrocution hits him, and he becomes magnetized. So all the cell doors and stuff start opening. Inmates are escaping, and
so I have a theory because, you know, as accident prone as Ernest is, he's been shocked so many times through the years that he's finally built up a tolerance to electrocution.
Well, I mean, in one of the final, like, you know, pivotal moments of this movie is, you know, him getting shocked inside the bank and, you know, it's like, oh, he's become polarized. He's weightless. So, you know,
yeah.
Or he's anti-gravity. So, you know, yeah, he's
now,
just.
Yeah, he's not magnetized. Like, now he's like reverse player. So instead of stuff attracting him, it's repelling him. So now he's like can float around and stuff. And he's like shooting lightning bolts at one point. I mean, yeah, science, not the strongest thing in an Ernest movie, but still comedic.
Yay, science. Still. Like, I don't know. I felt like, you know, it's like, I'm not sure if this is Ernest or Raiden here, you know, shooting the lightning bolts from the hands and everything. But.
And one thing, too, go back to our security guards, Chuck and Bobby. I think it's the first movie where they were there together because, like, Chuck is in Ernest Goes to Camp. Bobby is in Ernest Scared Stupid because, like, Tom and Bobby. And then finally we get the iconic Chuck and Bobby finally yes. together. And I don't know if it was scheduling problems in the other movies, but, yeah, finally.
But, I mean, they make an interesting duo.
Yeah, I mean, they're an early Penn and Teller.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, freaking Chuck who's, you know, old as shit and everything else, but dude is handy with a revolver. Like, you know, at one point, Ernest, like, and these guys are like the epitome of ultimate preppers, too. Like, apparently these are Ernest's neighbors, but, you know, he starts walking, you know, over to the yard, and he's like, damn it, I hate this minefield. So they've got a miniature minefield laid out. Like, you walk in and, you know, freaking Bobby's, you know, over there using the front door as a, you know, shooting range. And it's like, Ernest, you're in the line of fire.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys are always great little cameos or sidekicks in these movies.
But then, you know, so Nash is trying to rob the bank ultimately to get his big score. And anyway, he does that by capturing one of the clerks and then captures, you know, Bobby and basically handcuffs them to the vault door and straps a bomb onto the door. So, you know, Ernest, with his weightlessness, is able to grab the bomb and the bomb shoots and we have a nice firework display. And poor Ernest, so we have the sad moment. Everybody thinks that Ernest is dead and, you know, everything else, and the stupid idiot sacrificed himself. Well, he falls back from the sky in typical Ernest fashion.
Yep, at least no one was hurt.
Yes. Never skips a beat.
I mean, if you can survive electrocution, it's plausible that explosives, because, yeah, since he was polarized...
But the other one that we really didn't talk about, Ernest in the Army. Like, that was another one that was pretty
that was his...
funny. Like, him very much outside of his element, all because he wants to be able to drive an Army truck, and he can't drive an Army truck without being an Army person.
Yeah. And, like, and this was the last of the Ernest movies. It came out in 98. You know, again, directed by John Cherry. It was like, you know, pretty much the last, you know, last version of Ernest. But, yeah, it's kind of funny, too, because it's just like, you know, he's like, you know, this whole movie has like a weird golf theme to it. Because it starts off, he's the ball retriever at a driving range.
I mean, why not, dude? He was at a camp with a golf cart that could drive all by itself.
Yeah, and how he, you know, instead of these machines that, like, actually pick up the balls for you, no, he, like, drives with his feet and scoops up the balls with, like, a little basket and chunks them up into the... which he later has to use that skill to, you know, clear a minefield where he just, like, on the front of the truck and is, like, scooping up mines and chunking them at the people that are pursuing him. But, you know, of course, to put his whole... golf skills to help him out later, the main terrorist who are, you know, president for life guy ends up is obsessed with golf and, like, is always, like, shooting golf balls and, you know, showing his skills, which guy had some skills. I mean, he put a golf ball in a mortar tube and whatnot, and but yeah, like, all his, like, you know, terrorist threats and stuff have, like, a golf themed theme to them, which is kind of odd.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of weird how, like, I don't know, like, the whole... So, this film here, almost going back to the Exeronius thing, like, you know, freaking Ernest consumes something. Like, so he's in formation and eating something. I forgot what it is.
It was gummy frogs. It was something gummy frogs things that were like super sticky.
Yeah, so it's like some kind of taffy or something like that. Anyway, like, you know, the sergeant's like, get rid of those or whatever the case is. Well, instead of pouring them out or whatever,
he chugs the whole box.
You know, pours a whole box in his mouth. And, you know, whatever the concoction is, or it has some kind of reaction. Anyway, he ends up vomiting after getting punched by the sergeant for being a dumbass.
Yeah, because pretty much it's like they skip the whole him having to have any kind of actual training. They're like, we're the reserves. We don't have to do all this stuff. You can just, you know, come join and we'll make you a truck driver. So he's like still in his traditional uniform of a t-shirt and a jean jacket, but now they've made
Don't forget the hat.
Yeah, but now they've made it green and brown, so it's like, you know, at least army colors. And he's like the, you know, in this very loose unit, but some like foreign dignitary comes and with an actual soldier, and he's like chewing Ernest out after he's like, you know,
yeah, ate all this stuff. Peacekeeping commander.
Yeah, and he's like, stand up, shoulders back, gut in, and hits him in the gut, and he just spews this like taffy slime right in his face. Yes.
I was like, damn it. I mean, they picked the most dysfunctional unit ever.
Yeah. And then, like, yeah, so his, yeah, he just joined so he could drive the truck, and then his unit gets called up to be like a support unit for this UN peacekeeping force that's fighting this weird, president. But so he's like the cook.
Karfistan or something like that. Krafistan. It's like some made up place.
Yeah. And he tries to cook pancakes for the troops, but he mixes powdered tank sealant instead of pancake mix. So the freaking pancakes are basically like armor plates when he gets done with them.
How awesome would that be? Like, you get attacked at breakfast time, well, screw it. Looks like a pancake? Nope. Armor plating.
When she throws it like a frisbee and it actually, like, sticks in the armor of a tank. Which he later uses as a weapon to take down the main bad guy once he runs out of explosives.
So, yeah, this film was just, you know, I don't know. I enjoyed the movie. But the other one I had the pleasure of watching, and I guess we'll kind of wrap up here. I mean,
this reminds, like, you can use burnt pancakes as a weapon, because I once went to a Waffle House, and the cooks were so stoned, they burned my waffle 3 times before I finally got one. And when I went to pay, I couldn't find them. I had to go out in the parking lot, and they were in the parking lot playing Frisbee with the burnt waffle. So...
I mean, that's not too far away from a boomerang.
Yeah. But speaking of which, I didn't get to watch this movie. How was Ernest Goes to Africa?
So Ernest Goes to Africa, like I was, you know, I had not seen this film, you know, prior to the weekend. So, you know,
until I googled the list of Ernest movies, I had never heard of this one.
So, you know, I'm sitting here and I don't really know what to expect. Like, I'm thinking today's era and how politically correct and everything else things are. Like, I'm like, you know, the Ernest films are in a lot of ways innocent, but, you know, the people's mindsets now are much more focused on social justice and stuff.
This was the early 90s. Yeah, you could still some questionable humor back
then. You know,
then.
So I was like, we'll see. So... anyway, basically, to set the premise is there's a jewel thief, and, you know, you've got an African tribe who, you know, is consistent of warriors and everything else. Well, you know, of course, they've got the big skull and, you know, typical, stereotypical, you know, African tribe thing. Well, this, you know, jewel thief basically steals 2 of the eyes out of this skull that are rubies or diamonds or something to that effect. So that's how... you know, everything kind of gets put into motion. And, you know, the guy is, you know, trying to run back to the plane to get off of Africa. And, you know, basically the pilot screws him over and says, throw me the bag, I'll pull you up. Well, he throws him the bag and the pilot takes off, leaving the guy, you know, to suffer whatever fate. So anyway, that guy makes it back stateside and, you know, ends up getting chased by, you know, whoever... you know, one of the big mafia bosses or something that some, you know, he was working for, and ends up dropping the bag in like a 2 for $1 been at, you know, a flea market filled with a bunch of other items. And who happens to pick up that bag out of that bin?
Ernest.
So Ernest is now in the middle of this big, you know, diamond trade shenanigans. So ultimately, like, he ends up, he's trying to impress this waitress at a, you know, little diner or something. And, you know, one of the other waitresses is like, well, you know, you should bring her a gift or something like that. Well, he uses these two jewels to make a yo-yo. So he paints it up all decorative and everything else and, you know, presents it to her as a gift, now adding her into the mix of shenanigans. So they both end up getting kidnapped and land in Africa.
So basically it's the plot of Crocodile Dundee 2, except kinda. It's Africa instead of going back to Australia.
That is correct. So, you know, ultimately, like, it was humorous, but I was like, you would catch some major shit for that nowadays. Anyway, you know, Ernest, he's a man of many vices. You know, at a third grade level, he's a maestro. You know, so he's like, oh, don't worry, you know, we're in Africa and we're all alone out here and everything with these bad guys chasing us. But luckily, I know 19 dialects of African tribe language. He's, you know, they run across this one tribe and they're trying to, you know, figure out, hey, where are we and where do we need to go for safety and to get off of the continent? And anyway, he walks up and instantly it's, what it do, man? What it do? Like, just straight up Ebonics. And, you know,
yeah.
He's doing the, you know, back in the day, everybody had a secret or some kind of official fancy handshake. So he's trying to do that with all the tribes people and stuff. And I was like, shenanigans.
Yeah. That's.
But the rest of the film really didn't, you know, cross any barriers or anything.
There was no blackface.
No.
All right. So it didn't go that far.
No.
All right. Because I was like, yeah, when I just saw the cover, I'm like, this is probably going to be bad. Because you know how Ernest likes to do characters.
Well, and, you know, he would do it harmlessly. Not that he's actually trying to do anything racist or malicious, but, you know, he's just not all that bright.
True. All right. So as we kind of finish things out, any final thoughts on Mr. Ernest P. Worrell, a.k.a. Jim Varney?
I don't know. Like, I mean,
did you have a particular favorite movie?
I think probably one of my, I mean, I would have to almost say Ernest Goes to Camp in a way. I mean, the other films are great, but that really, you know, set the stage for so much of, you know, what the later films brought. Yeah, you know, Ernest Goes to School would, you know, be up there on my list just because, you know, it had some iconic moments in itself. You know, him basically trying to, you know, serve as the school janitor and everything else and, you know, basically having to, you know, get a high school equivalent education at a third grade level, you know. So, I mean, he was making a stride to better himself.
Yeah, I gotta say, like I said, Ernest Goes to Camp, probably my favorite. It, you know, all the other movies kind of fit that formula. It was trying to recapture that, with the exception of, I think, Ernest Saves Christmas. That's probably the most different of all the other ones, which, you know, also ranks pretty high up on my Ernest list. So, any final thoughts on the, as I knock the crap out of my pop filter here, if you want to hear that,
They heard
on
it.
On the cigar.
I mean, my final thoughts are, it's not a bad cigar. It's not my favorite. I think I like the Exodus that we smoked previously a little bit more than I do this one. I will say that, you know, throughout the, you know, down to the first third and into the half, you know, I would say it became more of a medium full. But then as I started getting further down, it's starting to taper off and, you know, full and go back to that medium.
Yeah, it's, like I said, I definitely, because I said that original Exodus was probably one of my favorite cigars, and this is a good average smoke. It's a good cigar, it's not a great cigar, because at least,
I mean,
especially compared to the original, because this one is a little bit milder than that original one that I enjoyed.
But, I mean, I've got a lot of cigar-smoking friends that I think would prefer this over, you know, the previous version, because they typically, you know, are looking for something more medium, maybe, you know, borderline medium full, but, you know.
And the price point, too, is not bad. It's like, yeah, 7.5 range in there. I mean, like I said, it's a good, you know, daily smoker or something like that. You know, it's not, like I said, a real great cigar, but it's a good cigar.
I mean, it's not the most memorable in the world. You know, a year from now, am I going to, you know, be like, oh, let me smoke this? Maybe not. But if somebody were to hand me this cigar, I wouldn't turn it down. And as far as the construction and everything else, it's all been, you know, perfect. I mean, I couldn't ask more for, you know, one, you know, so much of a burn relies on proper humidification and everything, but it also has to do a lot with the construction. So I can't, you know, I'm not going to knock it from a construction standpoint or anything from that aspect. Just the flavor was just eh, and it's, you know, not just going to be one of those iconics. But like I said, should somebody hand me this cigar, I'm going to be happy with it, and I'm not going to turn it away.
Yeah, and before we exit, I got to give a quick product review here, because, you know, we've definitely talked about a lot of, you know, cutters, lighters, whatnot, and you rarely, you know, pretty much a cutter is a cutter, especially when you're dealing with Zycar. They're pretty much all, you're going to get different construction materials, different looks, you know, does artwork on them, but the Zycar cutter is kind of an iconic design, and there's not much difference. But for Christmas, I got one of the new Zycar XO cutters. Thanks, buddy, by the way. Or as I like to call it, the hockey puck. This is a great cutter. If you've not picked one of these up, you should definitely get one. It's, like I said, it's round. It's you know, definitely a, you know, innovative new design. And it has like little gears in too, so the blades all close at the same speed, so you get an even cut no matter how you kind of press it down. But the thing that I really impress about it, because, like I said, the original Zycar, as I've gotten into smoking bigger ring gauges, because that's kind of like the popular thing now is the big ring gauge cigars, it's harder to cut them with my old Zycar because it's like a smaller ring gauge. Well, this one, I think, is like up to a 64 ring gauge, so it's a lot bigger cutter. So even with, and the other thing was box press cigars, because like the Flathead 660 is another one of my favorite cigars. And I used to always have to use a punch for that because it would not fit in my traditional Zycar cutter. And this one passed the Flathead test. I mean, even with that, you know, those oddly shaped, like, you know, box press cigars, it's still got a good cut on this thing. So that's my recommendation for anyone looking to pick up some new gear in 2017.
And, you know, just as a general recommendation, you know, I mean, I don't want to, you know, turn this into, you know, too much of a product advertisement thing. But, you know, when I was first getting into cigars, you know, I would buy the cheap plastic $5, you know, cutters or whatever the case is, because they would get me through. What I learned is that after buying four or five of those, if you'll just buy one quality cutter from a company like Zycar or, you know, whoever, is oftentimes you're going to find a lifetime warranty, and stupidity is covered within that warranty. So, you know, if there's a product defect or if you do something dumb and end up breaking it, all you got to do is ship it back and they either fix it or ship you a brand new one. And a lot of cases, you know, what I'm finding is, you know, folks think they're going to, you know, get a repair and instead they get a brand new product. So, yeah. You know, for a company to stand behind its product and everything, like, you know, make the initial investment and it's a one and done, and you don't keep buying, you know, crappy products that you're going to replace every few months or, you know, a couple of times a year. So you end up saving money in the long run.
All right. And with that, we'll be right back.
Hey, man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And we're back. And it's time for Beer 30. First Beer 30 of 2017. So what are we drinking this week?
So we're drinking the Bourbon Barrel Aged Stout from Uinta Brewing Company out of Utah.
Yep, based in Salt Lake City.
So this is going to be an American stout. Judging by the name, it is aged in bourbon barrels. So this comes in at a 7% ABV. And I've got to say, you know, this beer is not very hoppy. I would lean definitely more toward the malty side, and all around it is delicious, and what I would anticipate and expect out of a bourbon barrel aged stout. Great winter beer.
The only downside is it's only a 7% alcohol, which when you're dealing with, say, an imperial stout, or most of the bourbon barrel stouts I've tried are, you usually have a lot higher alcohol content than 7%, so I'm not getting that warmingness of a higher alcohol stout that I'm used to getting.
Yeah, I mean, but I will definitely say that, you know, the notes of bourbon and definitely the oak, you know, come through on this beer. So, you know, I'm with you. I would like a little bit, you know, higher gravity to this, but, you know, for the style and, you know, the clarity and everything else, I mean, so far it's been a damn good beer. I mean, we've had several other beers from this brewery, and, you know, everything that I've had so far has been pretty good. So, you know, I would almost say that this is a you know, almost a homebrew equivalent of a, you know, bourbon barrel stout.
Yeah, and it's...
I mean,
It's not as heavy as most stouts, though, so
yeah.
This is one you could probably drink a couple of. I mean, you'll have to get drunk, because it's only 7%.
Well, I mean...
Which is still... I mean, it's low for us, but that's still pretty high. But normally, like I said, a good imperial stout is very heavy, where you're only going to have like one or two before, you know, your stomach's full. But this right here, I feel like I could have a couple of these, and it's like a session stout, nearly.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, with this, you know, you're not going to get, you know, some of the... you know, the heavy body there, but sometimes it's nice to be able to not have that weight on your stomach and everything. I mean, you know, oftentimes we drink a beer, and after one of those, you're pretty much done. You know, whereas with this, I could have two or three, and I could be in a nice, happy place and, you know, enjoy myself.
Go to your happy place.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't have anything negative to say. I do want to give a shout-out. You know, in our perusings and everything else, to find craft beer and, you know, a place that has a rotational stock and, you know, just a vast selection of beer.
And a vast knowledge of beer, too.
And a vast knowledge of beer. You know, Dawson Fine Wine, you know, is really treated us right. You know, it's the one place that not only for beer, but for just, you know, whether I'm looking for a good bourbon or anything else, you know, kind of a one-stop shop. I mean, that's really nice for a, you know, community liquor store. Most of the time, you know, they're set on their brands, but, you know, these guys are, hey, if there's something and you're interested in trying it.
Yeah, every time I've gone in there, they've always had like a recommendation, no matter what I'm looking for. So, yeah, good place to, if you're in the area, to pick up some juice for the weekend.
Absolutely. So, you know, just wanted to give that shout out. But, you know, another, you know, fine recommendation. And I got to say, too, that it's priced right. You know, I mean, you know, oftentimes, you know, to your point, you're talking the Imperials and everything else. I mean, oftentimes for a bomber, we're paying well over, you know, 10, sometimes, you know, 15 and upwards, you know, for that bomber. So, you know, this is definitely a economic brew where you could drink several and not break the bank.
So what are you giving this one on the old scale?
I'm at a 4 here. You know, I would like a little bit more of that warming sensation. But, you know, I didn't, you know, check the ABV prior to recording or anything else. So, you know, I wasn't necessarily after something specifically, you know, double-digit ABV. But, you know, it's compared to some of the, you know, bourbon stouts and stuff that you and I have brewed, I got to say that it's on par, you know. And
yeah, I mean, if I'm comparing it to other bourbon barrel stouts, I kind of have knocks and points just because, like I said, it's not up to that level of strength. But when you're comparing it to, I don't know, a beer in this price range, it's a good beer for its you know, the price range and stuff that it's at. You know, if I was paying $15 for an Imperial Stout and got this, I would not be happy. But like I said, it's, you know, being at 7%, you know, it's unfair to judge it against its higher priced, higher alcohol content brethren. But yeah, this, like I said, this would be a good, like I said, going out to dinner and having a couple beers beer versus, you know, a strong stout that's going to put you on your ass.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, this would be a great beer to share with some buddies, have a, you know, a couple, and, you know, be able to enjoy yourself. And
yeah, have a few of these around your campfire, you know, or while you're grilling. You know, because normally I try to go for a lighter beer when I'm going to drink five or six in a session when we're cooking or whatever. But this one, you can have that nice stout flavor that you like and not really break the bank or the alcohol and be drunk before dinner.
And still be able to function.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes a necessity. So,
all right. With that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for Blowing Smoke.
And welcome back to the podcast. Time for another Blowing Smoke segment. Today we have a couple filmmakers in the Nerd Cave Studios. We have Corey and Brian from,
Unruly Mile Productions.
Unruly Mile Productions.
Unruly Mile Productions.
There you go.
I'm doing my NPR voice over here.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, one of the reasons why we have you in the studio is because we were doing a little filming for your next upcoming project. You want to tell people a little bit about the Teach Me Something?
Yeah, the podcast or this web series is basically, instead of me going on YouTube and teaching you how to do something, I have other people teaching me how to do things, and you get to watch, basically. And so we had Joe come on for the premiere episode to teach me the proper way to light a cigar and what else, best way to tie it into the podcast. And I think I learned something. I'm still a novice. You know, I didn't chop my finger off in anything.
Yeah, we had no fatalities, other than I don't know what the effect of this cigar you brought us to try was.
Yeah, we also were filming a pilot for another segment, and I brought a penthouse cigar that's been, 14 years old?
Yeah, improperly stored.
Yeah, just in a tube, no humidification. Yeah. And when it was new, the reviews were bad. 15 years later did not help it much.
I mean, I thought everything got better with age.
Only whiskey and but not, you know, bad cigar. You can age a good cigar. You cannot age bad cigar.
Yeah, I think it wasn't wrapped in a third world country, I don't think.
No. This was probably in like some back alley in L.A.
At least they had a centerfold, you know.
Yeah, that was the upside. You could get to see boobs when you opened it up to distract you from
the flavor. But even then, like, we have the internet.
Yeah, but back then they didn't have the internet. This was their source.
Pre-free porn.
Yeah.
But
I mean, they just weren't surfing hard enough. I mean, it was 2002.
Yeah.
But you humored me. You know, I think it was fun. You know, if anything, we got a few laughs out of it. It's still smoldering. I think we got about three puffs out of it before we killed it.
Yeah, tapped out on that one.
Yeah, I don't think it's getting lit again.
The other reason why we have these gentlemen here, we did an interview, about a year or so ago on day one filming of the Steampunk Boba Fett sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's done. It's out there. You can probably find a link in the description of this episode whenever it goes up to watch it if you haven't watched it already. So, yeah, tell the people about what the film was. And
so this is Trial of the Mask. This is the sequel to, this is Mask of Vengeance.
Yeah.
Sorry, both of them are called Mask something. Anyway, this is Mask of Vengeance, sequel to Trial of the Mask. I think our editor can probably fix all that, right? Wink, wink, yeah. Nudge, nudge.
Probably.
Don't make me look an asshole.
I mean, we could definitely cut and splice.
The third one's going to be called, like, Hockey Mask of Vengeance or something.
Don't give him any ideas.
I think somebody's already did that.
The Mask of 13th or something?
I think that's copyright.
Oh, wait, The Mask of 13th? No, that'll be perfectly
that one's
fine.
Safe, yeah.
You know, we'll just have John come back from the dead and, you know, kill all these helpless little virgins.
Zombie just, Boba Fett.
Just a whole, like, leather face mask made out of Gungan.
Hey, he's a Sith now. Leave Jar Jar alone.
He's a Dark Lord of the Sith arts.
You guys can't scent the sarcasm in the room. So. But anyway, yeah, we just finished it up right at Dragon Con. We did premiere at Dragon Con. It's a nice little tale. We brought back a few characters, had some new ones, and your host here was our lovable Java. Although I ended up being the voice, just partly because I just want to try to do it.
But probably everything I said was unusable and dirty.
Yeah.
I think you were enjoying the slave girls a little too much.
I got to say, I felt like a pimp that weekend. I was like, this needs to be my life all the time.
And we actually had a comment on the video about how Jabba gets all the girls.
It's like, I gotta look at this guy. I haven't read the comments yet.
But but no, it was good. We got it filmed in a little over a year, or filmed and edited. At the end of the day, I think we had about 5 good filming sessions. We'd done one at Sloss Furnace, which is out in Birmingham, perfect for steampunk people.
Yeah, I want to go out there. That place looks amazing.
Actually, interesting, we were talking about cigars, puffing them, get the smoke effect. Our writer, Phil, was smoking one for his character, and there was a great shot of John walking down the aisle or the alleyway.
Yeah.
And it went after he just got through smoking, so it gave that nice haze in there. So,
and it just lingered. It was perfect. It lingered for a couple minutes.
Yeah. But, you know, smoke machine, less cancer. Our smoke machine didn't work out too well, did it?
No, we actually forgot to turn the smoke machine on.
Because
it was an annual machine. It wasn't one of those auto ones. You had to press a button. Our slave girl, we forgot to cue her every time we wanted smoke.
Yeah, when you have no crew, it's kind of hard to remember everything. But, we got that one done. What else did we film? We had done a cantina scene where we got our bounty. That was pretty fun. We actually turned a S&M dungeon into yes. a cantina. So,
yeah, I like the origin of the bar you told at Dragon Con.
Yes, it is a see-through coffin that was used to put subs in.
You should have just had a slave girl in the coffin. Like a whole like Hans Obo and Carbonite, you know. Instead you got a stripper in a coffin for the bar.
We do have a very fetish underlying theme, and even though John doesn't know it.
Yeah.
You know, you do what you have the resources for. You know, it's like, well, I know these people and they'll help out.
Yeah, a little bit of Boba fetish. Yeah. I mean, so what was the hardest part of making it, the actual shooting of it, or the year of special effects and post production?
I don't know the hardest thing I had as being director is just getting everybody on set. You know, just making sure they're there. When it came to like the special effects, I learned how to do all that on my own, so I got to work on my own time. I was able to score the music so I could work on my own time, but the hardest part is getting people on time, getting to know their parts. Fortunately, the video side, Brian took care of all that. I had no worries. I just, here you go, here's our shots. You worry about that. I'll worry about why, you know, Jabba doesn't have his pants on yet.
Hey, he had to air it out.
What do you think was hardest on your side?
I think there are two hard parts. Probably coordinating everything. We had an entire cast of cosplayers constantly going to the cons and events and whatever cosplayers enjoy doing. And then learning how to film with basically nothing. Like old school, just camera and very little bit of lighting equipment.
Because a lot of times it was him running camera. I was running sound. Fortunately, we had one guy, Tommy, come out and run sound during Sloss. It was just too chaotic for me to do that and direct, because we filmed 6 scenes that day and like 6 hours. We basically had an hour a scene, so we just DIY to the max.
It was very run and gun.
Yeah, I was the one day I was on set. I was amazed at what you turned a little basement room into Jabba's palace. I mean, it looked amazing for not even just for like a no budget production. I mean, it looked amazing. I mean, I was like, I want this in my house now.
Well, you know, go to Amazon and buy $100 worth of fabric and go to Goodwill and buy a chicken skewer for a rotisserie I made a weapon out of. And I came back and go, hey, look at this cool little thing. And it's like, oh, that's from a rotisserie. And I'm like, but if you turn them around, it looks like a cool weapon.
Well, that's like John, because when he's like, all right, we're building this platform to put Jabba's throne on. I'm like, is that fat man like approved? He sends me a video of him and Lee jumping up and down on the box to show it would hold Jabba. That's the guy's like, I don't want to fall over in the middle of shooting this.
But we had Dan, he had steampunk spaceship, basically. It's on a golf cart, and we went blue screened. That was an interesting blue screening, that outside in the wind.
Yeah.
But he made this, you know, little rotating lazy Susan,
yeah.
And we could just put the camera up there, and we could turn it any direction we needed to. And
Dan's like a mad scientist. I used to play paintball with Dan. He would always build like these weird weapons and tanks and stuff. I mean, the guy is a closet mad scientist.
Oh, and he built us a minigun on the front of the speeder out of paintball barrels. Yeah. It was pretty cool.
It was supposed to be a machine gun, paintball gun, but he just put it on there instead.
Give him another week, it'll probably work. Like, he'll probably get to a tournament somewhere.
Oh, yeah, we asked to put weapons on it, and he had like bazookas on, or laser bazookas.
Yeah, bazookas and a chain gun, and and it's spun and everything. You can see it in the movie.
But then we were able to, everybody was able to pitch in. We had a guy build an iBot, and they did the steampunk creations. Everybody built their own costumes, so that was great. You know, not everybody's actors, but you kind of...
These are all cosplayers. Yeah, these aren't professional actors.
We're having fun. One of the most interesting things about shooting was our Darth Vader was in Germany. So me and Brian, well, Brian taught him. I just kind of rambled a bunch of crap. But Brian taught him how to do green screen. He's never shot it before. He'd done some video. And really, two tries. I think one time it was just the resolution was too small.
Yeah, his camera settings are off.
But the lighting was great. It was just
Jedi's.
I was actually able to.
We should have had German Darth Vader.
And I still got to use the footage because we used it for the hologram. I was like, well, yeah. You know, so I was able to use everything.
Actually, the next hardest thing was those scout troopers we did on the roof of your condo. I forgot about that.
So
that was a nightmare.
Interesting story. We drive up to Dragon Con because they're in Wisconsin, so they come down for Dragon Con. Pick them up Sunday morning. They're hungover.
Yeah, we met those guys in Ohio a couple years ago. They're doing those costumes.
We threw them in the car, drove to my house, put them on my rooftop, put the blue screen up, filmed them on the blue screen in the daylight and most harsh light. Somehow we made it
work. Worst imaginable lighting and the worst wind. It turned into a sail.
Yeah.
We were trying not to lose it into downtown Atlanta.
And we wrapped them back up, took them back down, and dropped them off at Dragon Con and went on about our business. It was cool. It was like an experience because you learn from what to do, what not to do. And I don't think we'd do it that way again. But
yeah, not a cloth backdrop. Maybe do the collapsible backdrops in the future.
When the backdrop is flowing, you guys can't see my hand moving, but it's flowing like a kite. Yeah.
Foley work.
This is the difference between like audio and visual. You can't see what I'm doing. And yes, I have pants on.
Maybe.
So what was your experience? How did you enjoy? It was your first time filming, right?
Yeah, it was the first time I've like done that character like on tape other than just roaming around Dragon Con. And it's very hot, but sitting in a nice air-conditioned basement all day with girls on leashes and whatnot. I mean, it was, and this is how I know I'm a total cigar nerd, because the place we were shooting, professional photographer, and he has this giant, like probably 6 foot wide picture of this hot girl smoking a cigar, and the first thing I'm like, oh, she's got a Cohiba. It was like that's the first thing I noticed, not the like half naked girl, like. So yeah, but yeah, it was fun. It's the first time I've been on like a, you know, filming set and just watching or knowing what we did versus what is on film. It's like, oh, this is a minute. We were there all freaking day, so it's cool kind of seeing that how much work goes into a project like that.
I mean, there's so much involved. I mean, from getting. Just making it all work and make the story, you know. It's such a simple story, but at the same time, it's like the audience got to be able to follow it, you know. I don't know. Well,
I mean, we talked about it earlier, the challenges of making anything is you can go out and buy a bunch of camera gear. You can go learn how to use it, but that's all great and all. Putting it together and actually telling a story is the harder part of learning how to make a film. Because you can make a bad-looking film and tell a good story, and it'll still be a good film.
I mean, is there any new things you learned on this one versus the first one y'all made?
You know, there's some personal things, you know, personal relationship things I've learned. The one thing I learned as I get into film from doing photography and playing in bands and stuff is, like, here I'm doing this. I'm thinking director. I wear my cool hat, my megaphone, and yell at people, but you don't.
Yeah, we didn't have a budget for a megaphone.
Mostly what I did was wrangle up people, make sure they're there, make sure Brian knows what shots he needs to get, and just coordinate everything. You know, it's basically a wedding planner.
Or a babysitter.
Yeah, a babysitter.
Make sure you have lube for the tongue. And
I did provide lube for the tongue.
Because John just had to have that tongue.
But, I mean, that's the kind of things I learned was I learned that there's more to it than just like, oh, here, I got a vision, and y'all make my vision happen. When I'm doing photography, it's just me. I can do it all, but here you can't do it all. You know, I mean, you can do as much as you can, but there's way too much involved to.
And it's a team effort.
Yeah. And because especially like this, we had some scenes, we had like the cantina, we had probably 15 people there.
Oh, yeah.
So you're talking about our cantina scene last time had like 4 or 5, you know, and this one's got 15, and you got to get them all in there, make sure they're acting and doing stuff. And also the continuity. It's like, okay, well, we just shot this. You got to make sure everybody's back in the same place. And, you know, it's a challenge, but it's a fun challenge, you know.
And, I mean, it's been out now for probably about a month or so as we've been. So what's the reaction been to it so far? I mean, is it turned out the way you wanted it to turn out? And because, I mean, I enjoyed it, but I was in it, so.
Most everybody that I've talked to seems to enjoy it so far.
Yeah, we got good reactions, I think. Everybody that I know that watched it was entertained.
Yeah, because, I mean, it doesn't look like a typical YouTube fan film. I mean, it looks like a legitimate movie. I mean, the digital effects on it looked awesome. I mean, the soundtrack to it was, I mean, I can tell y'all put a lot of work into making this thing look right.
You know, it's best we can with the, you know, what we have available. I mean, there's always limitations. We're not Hollywood. You don't have budget. But, you know, with things, that's the nice thing about technology now. Yes, like we were talking earlier, like everybody talked to you as a podcast of sorts. And even like bands, everybody's got a band or, you know. But at the same time, the technology is like, we can take a couple of DSLR cameras, some lights, and some sound and gear, probably spend less than $2,000 on it, you know, or something, and go make a film, you know.
All right, the most important question is, what's your next movie, and do I have a role? Preferably one without a mask, so someone can actually see my face next time.
I don't know.
So if John's listening, it's not going to be another steampunk Boba Fett movie. We're a little burned out on that one.
Western.
We have ideas.
Horror movie. We're
kind of toying around with this concept. We did one. We just did a short film for a NASA film festival. But we're liking this minimalist thing because that movie took so long to do for 10 minutes where we got a two-man team, a lot of times with two actors, and doing like a two-minute movie. And most of the time, we can turn around within 2 weeks. It's like this little, you know.
I like to call it triple-double.
Yeah. But it's like we just got through filming like a horror spoof kind of film that we're editing now. We'll have it out by Halloween. And it's a chance for us to like just practice, you know. Do other things like, okay, instead of putting another year into a big feature, let's just do this, okay? We may try to do like a, I don't know, film noir style one time, or, you know, a French New Wave one, or just whatever, you know. So, yeah, we may be like, hey, man, you got a Saturday free. You got three lines you got to learn, and, you know, and just have fun with it.
Yeah, because that seems to be the thing with the YouTube space is putting stuff out consistently. And like with a Hollywood movie, you get a movie, and then you 2 or 3 years to drop the sequel. But with YouTube, it's like, yeah, if you don't have something up like monthly, people start to forget about you. So it's a little bit easier to do like, you know, a web series like y'all are planning than a big feature production.
And people's attention spans are, you know, when we were talking about the podcast, people listen to it in their car. But, you know, YouTube is like you get on there and people watch it for like, what do we say? They're like, watch a minute and a half or something before they turn it off.
We try to keep it under 3 minutes.
Yeah, because people are just like, oh, let's go see what else is, you know, let's go see how teach a giraffe how to, you know, breastfeed.
I must be YouTubing all kinds of wrong because I find myself like 7 hours later, like, what happened? Where am I?
I think like about 10 minutes is like the max for most like YouTube shows that I watch. You start getting to like the 15, 30-minute mark. It's got to be interesting to hold you into that thing. Even if it's interesting, half the time, like, oh, hey, look, this suggested video over here, you know, ADD. Let me click on that and see what that is.
Oh, come on. You don't go into the Russian art films and stuff like that. I find myself liking all the creepypasta stuff here lately on YouTube. So
I've been watching a lot of the freaking the hydraulic press channel. It's the dumbest thing. Just some Finnish guy crushing stuff with a hydraulic press, and it's like, I've got to watch that.
what is the one that is a dude, Oddity Archive, and this guy, he just
that
talks.
Great.
It's weird because he's got a microphone, but he's got a box in front of his face, and it's just his eyes, and he'll talk about weird stuff. He was talking about VCRs, and he was talking about old Laserdisc players, and he was talking about these weird shows, and then lasts like 5 minutes to like 20 minutes, but it's so intriguing. Because it's very dry.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, I can't
but
get
But it's in. Really engaging.
Yeah. Because you're like, what's he talking about next?
I've fallen down so many weird conspiracy videos like, the top 15 abandoned ships, the top 15 haunted houses. And I'm like, I watch that for far too many hours than I want to admit. It's falling down a YouTube hole. I mean, hell, half the time we're sitting here recording the podcast and we're looking for like some clip to use as an intro, and then we end up falling down a freaking YouTube hole, and like an hour later, oh yeah, we were still supposed to record that podcast.
Well, I know you go out to all the Star Wars theories ones. And, oh man. Yeah, you should check out this theory.
Sit up till the wee hours of the morning, like, suggested videos. Oh, I got to see what this one's about.
That suggested videos thing is the freaking worst.
Oh yeah. Right,
so as we wrap up here, where can people follow what y'all are doing and find your videos? And
The Steampunk Fett, basically simple. You just go to YouTube and Google Steampunk Bubba Fett. The channel's up there. I think it's just go / Steampunk Bubba Fett. For those movies, we're getting off the ground with our Unruly Mile. To Teach Me Something, stuff should be going here within the next couple months. I don't know when this will be released. So, yeah,
whenever that comes out, let us know. We'll share the episodes on our stuff and let people know that to check that stuff out when it comes out.
And our Unruly Mile stuff, our shorts and hangers, which is basically short films and proof of concept videos,
just little one-off videos.
Yeah, because a lot of times we'll try it a website like today, like we film two different types of web series ideas. Well, who knows? A month from now, they just don't work, and so you do the proof of concept, you move on, and see what works. And, so many people just get into one and just start doing it. But, we definitely check out the Steampunk Fett stuff because that's what we're most proud of at the moment and got finished up. I think that's about all I can.
All right. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Marvel Universe. The Earth Station MCU podcast is your home for all things related to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Join our debrief as we discuss Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agent Carter, upcoming and past favorite Marvel movies, cosplay, comics history, toys, games, interviews, and all things MCU. Whether you're a hero or a villain, a new viewer, or have been reading comics since you were a kid, there's something for you on Earth Station MCU.
And now, all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News. First news of 2017. Are you excited?
Yay. So what do we got on the agenda for?
Well, 2016, I just want to kind of recap. We haven't had an opportunity to discuss, some of the events and stuff that happened, at the time of our recording, the Christmas episode and, this episode. So we took, a little bit of a sabbatical for, friends, family and the holidays and that type of thing. So, we touched briefly on Rogue One, and, I just heard today that Rogue One is still number one in the box office for the fourth week in a row now. So, nice. I've kind of been seeing,
Yeah, I've watched it twice. So
yeah. I either see people that love it or I see people that hate it. Like there's, seems to be a pretty, well-defined line there. I personally love the film. So, we got some sad Star Wars news that, Carrie Fisher, passed away at the age of 60. And, it's been a few weeks now and...
Yeah, it happened after our last recording, so we've not been able to comment on it publicly. You know, I post some stuff on our Facebook page. But yeah, out of all the many deaths of 2016, and some of my friends are musicians and stuff, and they were, you know, a lot of the musical people that passed away was huge on it. But this is the one that literally, like I said, I mean, our princess.
Dude,
most of the people our age, that was our first crush. Was, and not only that, but female people, you know, that was their first hero of, like, you know, because she wasn't just the damsel in distress. She was, like, the leader of the rebellion, or a leader of the rebellion. So it gave something for, you know, girls to look up to. So yeah, that one was a kind of a hit all of us in the geek community hard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so many people were like, oh, we're in the woods, you know, 2016's almost over, and bam. You know, it 2016.
Yeah, because like I said, it's kind of sad news, and I'm wondering how it's going to change the new, because I've been reading a lot that she filmed all her stuff for episode 8, but supposedly she was supposed to have a big role in, you know, episode 9 as well. So wondering how they're going to adjust their future Star Wars plans.
So do you
based
think that
this.
They change, you know, from live acting to some kind of CGI? Or do you think that now they, you know, pretty much, you know, kill off the Leia character?
I don't know. It could be, you know, they took out Han, so, you know, and so it may be one of those things. Depend on how, you know, if they leave episode 8 intact of how they've shot it, how much stuff gets set up that's supposed to be in, that they would require for her in episode 9. But yeah, like I said, we saw in Rogue One, they can bring dead characters back to life. So, you know, maybe they finish out this movie with a CGI Leia and end her story, you know, in the next, you know, after under episode 9. Or, you know, like I said, at this point, if they can bring Peter Cushing back to life to play Grand Moff Tarkin, you know, anything's pretty much possible at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, that's kind of been the thing that, yeah, I've gone back and forth with in my head is, you know, how does this impact the franchise?
Or do they just, I mean, we've not seen them do this in Star Wars, but, you know, recasting the character. I mean, they've done it in other franchises like the Harry Potter films where the original Dumbledore died and it was recast. So,
I mean, yeah, we've, you know, and I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the things that kind of flashes back is, you know, Paul Walker with the Fast and Furious franchise and stuff like that, and how they kind of, you know, did the ending there, you know, and I just don't know. I mean, I guess we'll wait and see. So, you know, but
she, because you can always pull, like, she's off leaving the government and she's just not here with, you know, the soldiers on the ground card, you know, like, which is from what looks like what they were doing with Paul Walker as the, you know, Fast and Furious series goes on, where it's like, oh, he's off being a family man with Mia, so he's not here getting into the shit with Dom and the rest of these knuckleheads. So, I mean, it's possible to continue on without killing off the character.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to wait and see, I suppose, you know, just it just really kind of sucked, and, you know, I'm glad that 2016 is over and we can look forward to 2017 and a brighter future.
Yeah. So what else is on the news front?
So up next is, you know, some television news, and more specifically, you know, relates to the CW. So basically the CW is already, you know, given early renewals to, you know, The Flash and six other of their television franchises. So,
is there, I mean, there's non-DC shows on the CW? That's all I watch on there.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. So we know for a fact,
it's
Arrow,
like that and Supernatural,
DC's Legends of Tomorrow, The Flash, Supergirl, and, you know, Supernatural are going to, you know, all be renewed. And then also kind of tying into another topic is that the CW is also picking up Constantine, you know, as an animated series. And it's actually going to, you know, bring the voice of Matt Ryan back. So, you know,
because they had that guest starring episode on Arrow, and it's part of their, which I've not watched any of their stuff over on their animated thing, CW Seed, which I haven't looked to see if any of that stuff is on the CW app or not, but they've done a few Arrow-related animated, because they had like a Huntress series on the CW Seed app. So yeah, but hey, maybe if this cartoon is popular enough, they'll decide to bring it back as a live action and weed it into the Supergirl, Flash, Arrow, yada 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 universe that they're.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a expansive multiverse going on within the CW and DC that it's hard to really keep up now. It's like,
I don't remember if we talked about that, but that the whole crossover thing they did, event they did, was pretty badass. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. It's definitely awesome to, you know, see so many of the characters in the same, you know, multiverse and everything. It's just, dude, my DVR like blows up. Like,
oh, that's the only good part about this whole like Christmas break, of all the shows taking a month off, is I finally got everything caught up. I'm still behind on Walking Dead. I've only got like 3 or 4 episodes into the Walking Dead, but all my other shows I'm zeroed out on. So when they start back later this month, I'm caught up until I get, you know, behind again.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. So, you know, we talked about Ernest and some family, you know, friendly movies and stuff like that. So, you know, and just your discussions and things that we've had. I wanted to let you in on a little bit of news that, you know, for the live action Beauty and the Beast movie, Emma Watson will actually be, you know, singing, you know, something there. It's one of the classics from the original film. So
is she actually playing Belle in this, or is she just voicing it?
Yes, she is actually playing Belle.
Wow.
So, you know, that was one of the things is, you know, how is, you know, she going to, you know, do the musical, because that was, you know, one of the big aspects of Beauty and the Beast and a lot of the Disney songs. So.
Yeah, pretty much. If you're in Disney animated movie, you've got to expect at least a few music numbers. You know, they basically all their movies end up being some kind of musical. But now that they're kind of doing this live action version, I mean, which is kind of weird in and of itself, but, you know, it's still going to maintain the musical aspect. I haven't seen a whole lot on this because, honestly, I don't really care that much. But I've seen some of the photos they've released of like the makeup tests of some of the. Because if you remember the original Beauty and the Beast storyline, the curse turned basically everyone. You know, not only turned created the Beast, but all his servants and friends and stuff in the castle were also turned into inanimate objects. So the live action version of, you know, the inanimate object humans looked creepy as shit. If nothing else, I can pretend this is some weird horror movie for an hour and make it through.
I think you're gonna be fine, my friend. Yep. So up next is Funko Pop. Like, dude, the whole collector craze is just
yeah, there's too many of them. If I start collecting, I will have to dedicate like a room and a second job to this obsession.
I mean, that's the thing. It's not only the money, but then the storage and everything else.
Yeah, because I see them and I'm like, oh my God, that's badass. No, I'm not buying it. Because if I buy one, one's going to turn into like 350.
Yes. So
no, I've fully avoided that for financial and space reasons.
Well, in preparation for a little film coming out, you know, in May called Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, you may have heard about it. Anyway, Funko Pop is releasing the Volume 2 Guardians. So you're actually going to get Drax and Rocket and Baby Groot, Lord, Star-Lord, and Gamora. So, you know, the freaking trailer for Guardians 2 just looks awesome. Little Baby Groot, you know, playing with the...
Don't touch the death button!
Yes. And all the shenanigans that will ensue. And then, you know, up next is a little game system. So Nintendo has been working on, you know, the Nintendo Switch. And we talked about it a little bit in one of our previous episodes. But basically they are set that on January 12th they will be revealing the price and the actual release date of the console. So...
yeah, I've seen some, like, you know, I've not seen any actual gameplay footage yet, but I've seen some of the trailers of how the Switch will work, and I gotta say, it is kind of cool that you know, the controller kind of connects to this tablet device, and you pretty much you can, you know, go from a home system to a portable system just by, you know, within seconds. And that's kind of always been the dream of the portable system market, because we've never been able to, you know, the portable games have always been lesser than the console games.
Yes.
So you never get that. You may get a version of Mario, Zelda, whatever, but you don't get the same thing you're playing on your big screen at home. But with this, the game is the same no matter which, you know, way you're playing it. And you can literally take the game you're just playing on your TV on the road with you and pick up exactly where you were at and, you know, continue the game, you know, flawlessly.
Yeah, and that's kind of been a thing that, you know, I've always kind of wanted. I mean, you know, and there really hasn't been a, you know, huge successful handheld, you know, platform that came out. I mean, you had the, you know, PlayStation, the Vita for a while, but
even the PSP before that. I mean, it was big for a minute and then kind of went away. Like I said, because that was, you know, going to be the whole, oh, they got video and all this other stuff, but again, you got that thing where you could not really connect it to your home system.
Yeah.
And so it was still just like, you know, a little bit of a lesser lesser console.
So I think, you know, that we'll definitely see, you know, more about the Switch. I mean, you know, they're calling this a presentation. You know, so this will be in Tokyo January 13th. It'll be on the 12th U.S. time. But basically, you know, Nintendo has confirmed that, you know, it plans to release the Switch, you know, worldwide around March. I hope that, you know, this release does better than what we've seen with so many of the other game consoles and stuff like that, where it seems to be that, you know, there's such a high demand. And it's almost like, the game designers.
That Nintendo Classic is damn near impossible to find right now. Still, even like, you know.
And, you know,
this far out from the holidays.
You know, that's the thing now. You know, so much of it being online, you know, shopping and everything else. I'm kind of glad to see that, you know, Congress has, you know, stepped in a little bit and, you know, tried to shoot down, you know, people using, you know, scripts and robotic programs and stuff like that. So when something new happens, it instantly goes and buys like 500 or, you know, whether it be. I know specifically they did that for like concert tickets and stuff like that. So,
yeah, because I know I've not been a Nintendo owner since the 64. But I mean, if it works like it says it's supposed to work, and the games are there, because like I said, Nintendo has kind of become the kid friendly console. So like I said, I've not played any Nintendo in a while.
But I mean,
if it works like, because that Zelda.
I mean,
preview
Zelda
looks freaking
awesome. I mean,
so if it works the way it's supposed to, where I can game mobile or game at home and it be the same experience, I may have to you know, at least try some Nintendo
I mean,
products,
you know,
again.
For me, it's kind of going to be, where does the price point start?
Yeah, that's the other thing we don't know yet, is what the price point on this thing is going to be.
I mean, I know, like, with the Wii and stuff like that, like, normally it started out, it was about $100 less than, you know, what Xbox and PS4 and, you know, some of the next-gen consoles were running. But, you know, then we had the Wii U come out at almost a $300 price tag and stuff. And, I mean, there's some great exclusive titles that Nintendo has, but, you know, for those two or three titles, is not necessarily worth a, you know, couple hundred or $300 investment for me, you know.
And that's one thing that's kept me out of the PlayStation VR so far, is that it costs the same as a PS4.
Well,
so.
With something like that,
and you still have to have a PS4 to run it.
Well, I mean, with something like that, too, I want that to be out for a while, because, you know, I want the bugs and the kinks and all of that, because, you know, we see it so many times that designers are trying to, you know, get to the marketplace so, you know, quickly that unfortunately they're not doing a lot of testing as extensive testing and everything. So things keep coming across as flawed, and it's like, oh, well, if you want to fix this flaw, then either download this, you know, update, or, hey, we released a DLC because we never actually completed this product to begin with, so now we're going to charge you an additional, you know, fee for what should have been in the game, in my opinion, at the start.
Yeah.
So, you know, just kind of my two cents there. But that's what I got for news.
All right. And as you heard in the interview earlier with the guys from Unruly Mile, by the time this episode comes out, that because we filmed that a while ago, the web series Teach Me Something should be up and running on YouTube. We didn't mention the links in that interview because, like I said, we were there in early, so they weren't links yet. And all that stuff will be included in our notes of this episode. And, of course, as soon as that episode goes live, we will put a link to it on our Facebook page and whatnot, since we were there for episode one. But if you want to check out what they're doing and follow along, as soon as I figure out where I saved that, their website is tmsseries.com, and you can find them on Facebook at facebook.com/tmsseries. So check that out. Like I said, we're part of episode one, and like I said, you heard the interview earlier. So check that out. Also, you can find us at cigarnerdpodcast.com. We're also on the ESO network at esopodcast.com. You can follow along at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at cigarnerdpod. And with that, know what I mean, Vern? And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.